Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, November 17th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. Governor Reynolds announces limited mask mandate, other COVID-19 mitigations. Iowans must wear a face mask and other face coverings while indoor, in public, and near other people for at least 15 minutes under a new public health order issued Monday evening by Governor Kim Reynolds. The face mask requirement is part of new orders issued as COVID-19 continues to spread rapidly through Iowa, creating the state's highest rate of cases, hospitalizations, and death during the pandemic. Reynolds' order, which went into effect at 12:01 a.m. Tuesday, also places a limit on 15 people on all indoor gatherings, including weddings, funeral receptions, family gatherings, conventions, and festivals. The order limits outdoor gatherings to 30 people. However, the restrictions do not apply to gatherings in the workplace as part of normal daily business or government operations. Restaurants and bars are allowed to remain open between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. In what is believed to be the first ever live address from an Iowa governor televised during prime time, Reynolds on Monday night posited that Iowans may have become complacent, possibly leading to the late spike in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. She warned those spikes threatened to overwhelm Iowa's healthcare system, echoing warnings issued by hospital officials. Reynolds noted if COVID-19 patients overwhelm hospitals, all Iowans who need healthcare will be placed in danger. Right now, the pandemic in Iowa is worse than it has ever been, Reynolds said. That's why I'm talking directly to you tonight to ask for your help, not just as your governor, but as a daughter, as a grandmother. It's up to us, all of us, so that the worst case scenarios that I just described don't become our reality. Reynolds' address came on a day when Iowa posted 2,350 new COVID-19 cases, bringing the total to 187,035 since the virus was first detected in Iowa last March. Monday's 6 confirmed deaths bring the total to 1,991. Iowa has seen hospitalizations more than double since November 1st, with Monday's number marking the largest single-day net increase. COVID-19 hospitalizations increased 113 on Monday to 1,392, an 8.8% jump that was the largest in a single day, with 271 patients in intensive care units and 123 needing ventilators. Iowa has the fourth highest rate of spread in the U.S., according to the latest report from the White House COVID-19 Task Force. Our healthcare system is being pushed to the brink, Reynolds said. The face mask requirement includes exceptions, including for people with a medical condition or disability that would be aggravated by a mask, the deaf or hard of hearing, people who work alone or more than 6 feet away from other people, people who are eating or drinking, and public safety workers whose duties would be hindered by a face mask. All organized youth and adult sports activities of any size are suspended under the governor's order, including basketball, wrestling, gymnastics, swimming, dance, and group fitness classes at gyms. High school, collegiate, and professional sports are allowed to continue, but spectators are limited to 2 per student and are required to wear a mask. Restaurants, bars, bowling alleys, arcades, pool halls, bingo halls, and indoor playgrounds are required to close at 10 p.m. and cannot host private gatherings of more than 15 people. Masks must be worn by staff who have direct contact with customers, and customers must wear masks where they are not seated at their table or drink to eat or drink. The proclamation also requires masks inside casinos. Hospitals must reduce inpatient effective procedures by 50%. The latest orders continued until 11:59 p.m. December 10. Reynolds did not require, but strongly encouraged, all in vulnerable Iowans to limit activities outside their homes, and encouraged all Iowans to limit in-person interactions with vulnerable Iowans. Studies have shown COVID-19 is more dangerous to older people than those with health issues. If Iowans don't buy into this, we lose, Reynolds said. Businesses will close once again, more schools will be forced to go online, and our health care will fail, and the cost in human life will be high. So now it is time to come together for the greater good, to look out for each other, not because you're told to, but because it's the right thing to do. That's who we are as Iowans, and I know, without a doubt, that we'll get through this together. This is a quote. Iowa U.S. Senator Charles Grassley joined the chorus Monday, taking to the Senate floor to urge Iowans to step up their personal responsibility in combating the COVID-19 community spread. Although promising vaccines for the coronavirus are on the horizon, it's more important than ever to stop the surge, Grassley said in prepared remarks. It's critical for Iowans to step up their personal responsibility to stay safe and healthy for themselves and for their loved ones. Summary of enhanced public health measures. Effective Tuesday, November 17, 12:01 a.m. until Thursday, December 10 at 11:59 p.m. Mask use. Indoor space open to the public and state executive branch buildings. Masks required when individuals are within 6 feet of one another for 15 minutes or longer, with certain exceptions. Gathering restrictions, social, community, business, and leisure gatherings. No more than 15 people indoors and 30 people outdoors. Restrictions apply to wedding receptions, family gatherings, conventions, and other non-essential gatherings, but do not apply to gatherings that occur during the ordinary course of business or government. Sporting and recreational events. Youth and adult groups, sporting and recreational gatherings are prohibited except for high school, college, and professional sports. High school sports and extracurriculars. Sporting, recreational, and extracurricular events. Only 2 spectators permitted for each high school athlete, performer, or competitor, and must wear a mask and maintain 6 feet distance from other spectators. Students can be closer than 6 feet and are not required to wear masks. Restaurants and bars. Restaurants and bars, including a wedding reception venue, winery, brewery, distillery, country club, or other social or fraternal club. Closed to inpatient person services at 10 p.m. No bar seating. Masks required when not seated, while playing games, dancing, etc. 6 feet distance between groups. Groups limited to 8 people unless larger group is all same household. Seating when eating and drinking and limit congregating. Fitness centers. Fitness centers, health clubs, health spas, gyms. Group fitness activities are prohibited. Casinos and gaming facilities. Masks required except when seated to eat. Closer or prolonged contact establishments. Bowling alleys, pool halls, bingo halls, arcades, indoor playgrounds, children's play centers. Closed to in-person services at 10 p.m. Masks required when not seated to eat or drink. Ensure that groups or individuals are 6 feet apart at establishment. Groups limited to 8 people unless larger group is all same household. Non-essential electrical workers. Elective surgeries. A hospital must reduce its inpatient non-essential surgeries to a level that uses at least 50% fewer beds than it did on average during September. Next story. Some Waterloo City Council members upset over police logo petition. Some Waterloo City Council members Monday criticized the Human Rights Commission's petition against the police department's logo. The petition calls on the department to abandon any reference to a griffin in its logo. The current logo, adopted in 1964, includes a stylized red griffin with a green eye on a gold-black background. The petition says the insignia heavily resembles the KKK dragon and evokes feelings of fear and distrust of law enforcement. More than 300 people had signed the online petition as of Monday, less than a week after the Human Rights Commission posted its petition online. A competing petition to keep the griffin was posted online. It says the current police insignia has nothing to do with the KKK, and the repeated excuse is a lack of education of what the griffin truly stands for. Police say the griffin represents vigilance. That petition has more than 500 signatures as of Monday. We were working toward cooperation and hopefully harmony in the future. And then this wrench was thrown into the system by one of our own departments, which really bothered me, Council Member Margaret Klein said. The city created a rebranding committee, which is accepting public submissions for new logo designs. Council members will first consider redesigns that include some form of a griffin. They can only consider other designs if there is no agreement on a design with a griffin. Council member Sharon Juan serves as a non-voting member on the committee. She called the Human Rights Commission's petitions totally inappropriate and urged people to give the committee a chance to do its job. The committee must provide its final recommendation for the logo to the council by June. After the council votes, it is city department's role to support what the council does, Juan said. Whether they like it or not, that's their role. And every department has done that with the exception of this one. Klein said she got calls from constituents who want the logo redesigned to put to a citywide vote. She suggested moving forward with that suggestion. I think this was done sneakily. It's behind the back. It's beneath us, beneath our behavior, Klein said. This action has created this tension. Council member Patrick Morrissey, a liaison on the Human Rights Commission, said he proudly signed the petition. He said the commission sees any depiction of the griffin as just a furtherance of something that has been so abhorrent to them and their community. I am proud of the Human Rights Commission, Morrissey said. I am proud of their voice. Digest. State seeking contact tracers. Officials with the State Department of Public Health are seeking qualified vendors to provide COVID-19 contact tracing and Case Investigation Services. State officials say the emergency procurement is needed because of the exponential increase in the COVID-19 case volume to provide additional resources to assist with coronavirus contact tracing and case investigation. The state's request for proposal process will be expedited and will seek a procurement and to pursue process an emergency contact with an anticipated start date within 7 calendar days after the announcement of award. Interested vendors will be asked to establish a team assigned to investigate COVID-19 cases and trace the contacts each affected person had with guidance from the health agency. Teams will be expected to work 7 days a week between 9 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. and provide a daily progress report to the state agency, including daily summaries of the number of cases investigated and contacts traced. Team members should, on average, complete 3 case investigations or 6 contact notifications per hour, according to the state's specification. Proposals from interested vendors are due by 11:59 p.m. November 17th. Details are provided at idph.iowa.gov/finance/funding-opportunities. 2 more inmates die. Officials with the State Department of Corrections announced Monday that 2 prison inmates have died, likely due to complications related to COVID-19 and other pre-existing medical conditions. Jonathan William Strain, 59, was pronounced dead at 4:47 a.m. Monday at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, according to the department. He had been transported there recently from the Anamosa State Penitentiary because of declining health. Strain had been serving a 25-year sentence for second-degree sexual abuse in O'Brien County. His sentences began on November 3, 2010. Also, correction officials reported Jean Edward Dreyer, 72, was pronounced dead. Dreyer was transported from the Clarinda Correctional Facility to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinic in Iowa City last week when medical staff noticed his conditioning beginning to worsen. He died at 6 a.m. Saturday. Dreyer was serving a life sentence for a first-degree kidnapping conviction from Dubuque County. His sentence began on May 3, 1994. State emergency money. The Iowa Executive Council voted 4-0 Monday to approve nearly $405,000 in emergency allocations or other payments to cover a variety of issues and damages. More than $146,000 was needed to repair damage to the Iowa Communications Network caused by erosion and the August 10th derecho that hit Iowa. Nearly $126,000 was authorized to deal with damage caused by a hot water loop failure at the state prison near Newton, while $52,000 was needed because of 2 mercury spills at the University of Iowa's College of Pharmacy building. Another $49,500 for the University of Iowa went to cover damage from a burst sprinkler and a musical instrument stolen at the Voxman Music Building in Iowa City. Those approving the items were Secretary of State Paul Pate, Agriculture Secretary Mike Nag, State Auditor Rob Sand and State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald. Governor Kim Reynolds did not participate in Monday's online meeting. Clergy urge mask mandate. Iowa religious leaders called on Governor Kim Reynolds to take action, including a statewide mask mandate, to protect the health and safety of Iowans and reduce the number of positive cases of COVID-19 in communities across Iowa. In a Monday morning news conference organized by the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa Leaders of Christian, Jewish, Sikh, and Islamic communities, said Reynolds must do more than ask Iowans to do the right thing. The message that has been delivered time and again for months is that Iowans will do the right thing, they said, in a call for the governor to follow recommendations of the White House COVID-19 Task Force. It is clear that message is not working. The exploding numbers demand more concrete action. It is past time to adopt the mandates recommended by our nation's experts. So now it is time Iowa leaders, beginning with our governor, do the right thing, they wrote in a letter signed by nearly 800 Iowans. Also, because of the toll of the pandemic extends beyond the infection itself, the faith leaders recommended Reynolds provide economic relief to small businesses and operated by Iowans. Editorial: Iowa must heal urban-rural divide. This editorial originally appeared in the November 15th Des Moines Register. There's a sickness in Iowa, and it's not just the coronavirus. Call it a sickness of the spirit. It manifested itself in 2016 and now has been ratified. Voting in Iowa falls in a pattern that is unhealthy. The poor parts of Iowa that are economically vibrant are growing and appear to have a bright future, voted heavily to change the occupant of the White House. People in the vast open spaces where population is declining and the future isn't as promising carried Iowa for an incumbent president who expresses their resentments. The pattern is not unique to Iowa, but it seems particularly stark here. Maps detailing statewide election results see a sea of red dotted with blue in urban areas. In the presidential race, the majority of voters in 93 of 99 counties voted for President Donald Trump, in some counties by more than 70 percentage points. The six counties that voted for Joe Biden included Iowa's five most populous: Polk, Des Moines; Lynn, Cedar Rapids; Scott, Davenport; Johnson, Iowa City; and Blackhawk, Waterloo; plus Story, Ames, which is the eighth largest. Some people will look at the election maps and see mere partisan disagreement, arguably a preference for smaller versus bigger government. After all, the map of the U.S. Senate race, which was much less personality focused, looked similar. Those same six counties voted for Democrat Teresa Greenfield, plus Jefferson, Fairfield, and Cerro Gordo, Mason City. Republican Joni Ernst won the race with a 91-county sea of red. And historians will say the rural-urban divide in Iowa is as old as statehood. Much of the same voting pattern showed up a decade ago in the vote that ousted three Iowa Supreme Court justices who were part of the unanimous 2009 ruling that allowed same-sex couples to marry in our state. Just nine counties voted to retain these three justices, the same six that voted for both Trump and Ernst, plus Jefferson, Muscatine, home of the city of Muscatine, and Winnesheik, Decorah. The urban-rural divide also cleaved the Iowa legislature, whose bills championed by the Iowa Farm Bureau frequently power through to adoption. Yet economic development initiatives put forward by the Iowa Chamber of Alliance, representing the largest communities in Iowa, also find tougher going. The divide was in full display in 2015 when Des Moines Water Works sued drainage districts in three rural northern Iowa counties, accusing them of funneling high levels of nitrates from farm fields into the Raccoon River, a source of drinking water for 500,000 central Iowans. The lawsuit was dismissed as a policy argument best settled by the legislature, but hard feelings linger. The risk for Iowa is that it feels as if the state's historical urban-rural divide is now on steroids, pushed to a new extreme by the us versus them polarization of today's politics. Arguably, rural Iowa votes in a way that wallows in resentment of urban success, and urban Iowa looks on with indifference as rural schools consolidate and small town main streets wither. Today, Iowans who used to be renowned for niceness prefer a national leader whose defining characteristic is meanness, especially toward urban areas where more liberals, racial minorities, and immigrants live. Many voters seem to delight in Trump, not because he governs well, but because he owns the libs. That was a quote. In Iowa, many of those libs in places like Des Moines and Davenport resent being lumped in with the much derided East Coast elites, just as many rural Iowans resent the stereotype regrettably voiced by then-presidential candidate Barack Obama in 2008, that bitter small-town Midwesterners cling to guns or religion or to antipathy to people who aren't like them. Enough. Giving the middle finger to the other side is not a plan, not for the country and not for Iowa. Last year, 69 of Iowa's counties lost population, reflecting an emptying out that stretches back a century. A house divided might continue standing, but Iowa will not reach its full potential until urban people pay more attention to the issues confronting rural Iowa and rural people cheer urban Iowans as they work to strengthen their communities. Though the election underscored our divide, it's time to come together. Whether a family lives in a town of 100 people or 100,000, we generally need the same things, including good jobs, good schools, affordable housing, and high-quality health care. We all would benefit from immigration reform, common-sense trade policies, action to address climate change, and assurance of equal treatment under the law. The more time that lawmakers spend on these issues of common good and less on wedge issues like abortion and gun control, the better. Overcoming the unhealthy divide in Iowa is a project for all who care about the state. Iowa cannot reach its full potential until we collectively work harder to understand the struggles of people across Iowa and develop policies that seek to lift up all of us, regardless of where we live. You are listening to the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, Give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First obituary, Gary Gene Ambrose, 80, of Denver, Iowa, passed away Monday, November 9th, of complications related to Parkinson's disease. Gary was born on April 6, 1940, on a farm east of Monona, Iowa. He was the son of Vincent and Beatrice Nichols Ambrose. On August 20, 1958, Gary married Shirley Grady at St. Patrick's Church in Waukon. From this union, they have four children: Victoria, husband Michael Libby of Burlington, Wisconsin; Todd, wife Linda Ambrose of Elk Run, Iowa; Craig, wife Susan Ambrose of Elbia, Iowa; and Troy, wife Sherry Ambrose of Hugo, Minnesota. Gary's greatest pleasure was spending time with his 12 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren. He is survived by his wife Shirley, his children and their families, and his sisters Rosie, husband Gary Brinker, and Marcia Pallas. He was preceded in death by his parents, sister Carrie Platten, and granddaughter Jennifer Libby. Gary was employed at John D. Deere, retiring after 40 years in 1999. Gary enjoyed farming, traveling, collecting antiques, hunting, fishing, and played on several ball teams, including the John Deere League. Gary and Shirley traveled to Alaska, Hawaii, Ireland, and the Czech Republic. One of his greatest joys was locating his first cousin in the Czech Republic, and later hosting the family in the United States. A public viewing will be held on Friday, November 13th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Haggerty Wyckoff's funeral service. Funeral Mass will be held at Queen of Peace on Saturday at 10:30 a.m., followed by burial at Mount Olivet. Anyone wishing to greet family outdoors are invited to the farm Saturday, 2 to 5 p.m. Social distancing and masks required for all events. Memorials may be directed to the Parkinson's Foundation and the American Macular Degeneration Foundation, AMDF. Condolences may be left at www.haggertywyckoffgroup.com. Llewellyn Harms, 103, of Tripola, died Friday, November 13, 2020. At Tripola Nursing and Rehab. Graveside services will be held on Friday, November 20th at 11 a.m. at Grace Lutheran Church Cemetery, rural Tripola, with Reverend Dennis Nyswag officiating. Visitation will be held on Thursday, November 19th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Red Egg Funeral Home in Tripola. Online condolences may be left at www.beckermillerredig.com. All attending the visitation are required to wear masks and practice social distancing. Luella Norma, daughter of Carl and Alma Schaefer Meyer, was born December 16, 1916, at the Artisan, rural Bremer County, Iowa. She was baptized on December 25, 1916, and confirmed on April 4, 1930, both at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Artesian, rural Bremer County. Luella received her education in the country school and St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Artesian, parochial school. On November 21, 1937, she was united in marriage with August Harms at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Artesian. To this union, one daughter was born, Joan. The family lived in the Waverly area prior to moving to Tripola in 1960, when August purchased Fred's Body Shop. Luella was a longtime member of Grace Lutheran Church in Tripola, where she was active in the ladies' circle and quilting circle. She enjoyed playing cards, especially pinochle. Bingo was an excellent cook. Quilting made a quilt for each of her granddaughters when they graduated from school, as well as her great-grandchildren. But her greatest joy came from spending time with her granddaughters and great-grandchildren. Luella is survived by her daughter, Joan, husband Larry Struck of Tripola, three granddaughters, Rhonda, husband Scott Miller of Green, Julie, husband James Bronner of Waverly, and Linnea, husband Daryl Heineman of Ventura, eight great-grandchildren, Adam, wife Jill Miller, Lisa, husband Seth Adams, Lindsay Peterson, Brady Peterson, Jacob Heineman, Matthew Heineman, Jonathan Bronner, and Andrew Bronner, three great-great-grandchildren, sister Mildred Dankenbrig of Cedar Falls, two sister-in-laws, Dolores Myers of Reedland and Dorothy Meyer of Des Moines, and many nieces, nephews, and extended family. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, August, who died on January 16, 1976, and her six siblings, Leota Meyer, Alvin Meyer, Eldo Meyer, Helen Trichke, Harold Meyer, and Eugene Meyer. Carol Faye Brace, B-R-A-S-E, 91, of Waterloo, died November 9th at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. She was born September 13, 1929, in Waverly to Elmer and Martha Miller Sauerbry and graduated from Waverly High School in 1946. She married Alfred W. Brace July 12, 1947, at St. Paul Lutheran Church, Waverly. He died May 25, 2011. She was a member and past secretary of Cedar Valley Historical Society. She volunteered in the gift shop at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. She was a charter member of the Ascension Lutheran Church and an active volunteer. She was a member of Keepsake Quilters, as quilting was a full-time hobby and a passion for her. She made approximately 50 quilts a year and donated many of them to various missionaries. Survived by sons Alan, Cedar Falls, Stephen, wife Carol, West Des Moines, Marvin, Omaha, and Kent, Waterloo. Daughter, Janet, husband, Jim Morgan, Centerville, Ohio. 10 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren, Zachary, Lillian, Liberty, Lillian, Lily, William, Ariana, Jameson, and Kieran, preceded by brother Forrest Sauerbry. Graveside services held at Garden of Memories Cemetery, Memorials to Ascension Lutheran Church Memorial Fund or Charity of Donor's Choice. View www.lockfuneralhome.com. Carol Ann Menken, M-E-N-K-E-N, 72 of Dyke, died Friday, November 13, in the intensive care unit at Mercy One, Waterloo. Carol was born September 28, 1948, in Waterloo, the daughter of Helmut and Alice Jansen Meyer. She graduated from Dyke High School and was a longtime resident of Dyke, Iowa. On March 18, 1967, she was united in marriage with Merlin D. Menken of Dyke United Methodist Church, where she was a member her entire life. Carol was active in the church and enjoyed using her gift of hospitality to make others feel welcome and cared for. Carol worked at the Cedar Falls Walmart as the department manager of fabrics and crafts from their opening until her retirement 25 years later. An avid seamstress and lover of craft making, she loves sewing for others and coming up with homemade treasures to share. Carol loved to be on the go and traveled with her family. Some of her favorite times were traveling to Lake Winnebosnish each year with the family. Her love for a good bargain meant she never passed by a Walmart without stopping to check it out. She had a knack for engaging everyone in conversation, which ultimately became an opportunity for her to brag on her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. She loved her family deeply and was always looking for ways to bring them together and make memories. She began preparing for the family Christmas 364 days before it arrived, scheming ways to fill the 4-foot stockings she handmade each member of the family, and coming up with scavenger hunts for clues to find gifts and other games to make the family gift opening time memorable. Carol is survived by her husband of 53 years, Merlin Minkin, a daughter, Kim, husband, Dave Franczak, a son, Richard Minkin, 5 grandchildren, Nick Elliott, Allison, husband, Brady Lahman, Austin Elliott, Caleb Minkin, and Mackenzie Minkin, 3 great-grandchildren, Ezra Elliott, Elijah Lahman, Peyton Lahman, 2 step-grandchildren, David Franzman Jr. and Mary Franczak, and many nieces and nephews and friends. Carol was preceded in death by her parents, Helmut and Alice Meyer. The family is having a private gathering to honor her memory. A memorial service will be planned at a later date due to COVID-19. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made in Carol's honor to Dyke United Methodist Church, Women in Mission, 439 Church Street, Dyke, Iowa, 50624. An online guestbook is now at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Susan L. Schultz, 71, of Waterloo, died Thursday, November 12th at Harmony House Care Center. She was born February 25, 1949, in Waterloo, daughter of Carl and Susan Landfear Schultz. She graduated from Columbus High School in 1967. She then attended University of Northern Iowa. She was a leader at school and in the community in the music scene. She was a very good artist, playing the piano, the flute, and sung all over. She got her talent for music from her father, Carl. Susan was a creative writer and excelled in her studies at school, always on the honor roll. Survivors include a brother, Carl, wife Linda Schultz Jr. of Omaha, Nebraska, and many classmates and friends. Graveside services will be at 1:30 p.m. Thursday, November 19th at Fairview Cemetery within Nerman there. Social distancing and masks are required. There will be no visitation. Haggerty Wyckoff grew up funeral services on West Ridgeway is in charge of arrangements. Condolences may be left with www.haggertywyckoffgroup.com. Ray John Tessau, T-E-S-S-A-U, 84, passed away Friday, November 13th at Mercy One Hospital in Waterloo. Visitation will be held from 5 p.m. until 7 p.m. on Tuesday today, November 17th, at Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Doyen Chapel in Wellsburg. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, November 18th, at the Wellsburg Reformed Church. Burial will follow at the Wellsburg Reformed Church Cemetery. Mass and social distancing are strongly encouraged and requested by the family. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be made by visiting www.ablesfuneralhome.com. Ray was born October 15, 1936, to Emil and Emmy Vogt Tessau. He graduated from Rhinebeck High School in 1954. He attended Waterloo Barber College. He followed that profession for 60-plus years. He also worked at Daco Corporation in Eldora, Iowa, and a school bus driver in the 70s for a few years. Ray married Carol Leanne Schmidt on June 25, 1965, at Wellsburg Reformed Church. They made their home in Wellsburg. They were blessed with four children: Karen, wife Mike, Hircus of Dyke, Marley, husband Bruce Ellis of Cedar Rapids, Lisa, husband Chris Olin Dyke of Cedar Falls, Jeffrey, wife Carrie Tessau of St. Charles, Iowa, and nine grandchildren, Hannah and Olivia Hircus, Emily and Quinton Ellis, Aaron and Josh Olden Dyke, Noah, Danica, and Liam Tessau. Ray was a member of the Wellsburg Reformed Church. He enjoyed being with his family, golfing, fishing, watching sports, and playing cards. He is survived by his wife, Carol, his children and grandchildren, and a twin brother, Roy, his wife, Susan Tessau, a sister-in-law, Janice, husband, Myron Van Horn, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, three sisters, Marlis Meester, Alice Elaine Enninga, and Marianne Tessau, a brother-in-law, Dale Enninga, and a niece, Brenda Enninga Cohen. Dolores Faye Flesner, Flesner, age 80, of Cedar Falls, Iowa, was born the daughter of Harm and Vera Kaiser Flesner on March 20th, 1940, near Allison, Iowa. She attended school at Pleasant Valley Township No. 5 in Buck Grove and later Applington High School. Dolores spent all her adult life at group homes. She loved going to Pizza Ranch and reading the Waterloo Courier and the Parkersburg Eclipse, and enjoyed doing crafts and playing bingo. Dolores passed away Monday, November 16th, at Cedar Falls Health Care Center of COVID-19. She was preceded in death by her parents, two brothers, Harold in infancy, and Marvin Flesner, a sister-in-law, Thelma Flesner, and a brother-in-law, Kent Warnecka. Dolores is survived by three sisters, Shirley Cassidy of Cedar Falls, Carol Warnecka, and Linda, husband Dickie Oldenberger, both of Parkersburg, and many nieces and nephews. Private family graveside services will be held at St. Paul's Lutheran Church Cemetery in rural Wellsburg, Iowa. Redmond Schwartz Funeral Home is in charge of arraignments. 319-346-1534. Genevieve J. Sadler, Sadler, 92, of Dunkerton, died Sunday, November 15th. She was born May 25th, 1928, in Waterloo, the daughter of Joseph and Genevieve Wilhelm Wyden. She married Lawrence Sadler April 23, 1947, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Gilbertville. He died April 26, 2020. Genevieve graduated from Sacred Heart High School in 1945. Her and Lawrence formed the family Century Farm in Dunkerton. She was a longtime member of St. Francis Barclay Catholic Church. Survived by a son, James, wife Dorothy Sadler of Dunkerton, five daughters, Kathy, husband Dick Cass Sadler, and Diane, wife or husband Bob Curry, both of Waterloo, Carol, husband Jerry Schoenthal of Waukon, Teresa, husband Wade Bance of Dunkerton, and Bonnie, husband Phil Baskerville Sadler of Cedar Falls. 12 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren, and a sister, Mary Kay Fischbach of Waterloo, preceded in death by her daughter and son-in-law, Pauline and Chris Toniff, a grandson, Chris J. Toniff, a sister, Josephine Sadler. A public visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 20th at St. Francis Catholic Church in Barclay Township. A private family mass of Christian burial will follow. Burial will be after the mass and is open to the public. For those attending the visitation, we ask that you please wear a mask. Haggerty Wyckoff Gorup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is in charge of arrangements. Sports. COVID-19 complications have tested Kansas State football. Kansas State has 78 football players test positive for COVID-19, according to the Kansas City Star. Currently, 12 Kansas State players have COVID-19, and several more are out due to contact tracing. The Wildcats haven't had to cancel or postpone a game this season, but if this week's three tests don't go well, they may have to. "We're right on the cusp," Kansas City coach Chris Kleiman said on Monday during the Big 12 teleconference. "Hopefully we have a good week this week from a COVID-19 standpoint because we're right on the cusp. I couldn't tell you the exact numbers, but it's more than we would have liked." Kansas State has had trouble all season handling the coronavirus, but this is the first time during the season the positive tests have spiked. "We got hammered in the preseason in those first couple of weeks of September when we were down 40-plus guys," Kleiman said. "Then we had a pretty good stretch where we'd only lose 3 or 4 a week, which was a low number and allowed us still to play. Then, right after West Virginia, we've been getting hammered again. If the game against Iowa State were to get canceled or postponed, it would join a myriad of other games that suffered the same fate in recent weeks. Unfortunately, I think that's going to continue across the country, not just at Kansas State, as we see everything spike," Kleiman said. "As many kids as we've had get COVID, I don't have the exact number, but I know it's more than half of our team. We still have a bunch of guys that haven't. That really worries you because, for whatever reason, infections are going up again." Kleiman is a native of Waterloo who played and coached at Northern Iowa. Kleiman's father, Bob Kleiman, was his high school football coach at Waterloo Columbus. Chris still leans on his father for coaching help. "Dad was a coach. He was a mentor. He was a leader. And he challenged the heck out of me every day," Kleiman said. "And he still challenges me today. That's the fun thing. I can bounce ideas off him, and he's a great Monday morning quarterback at times, which is awesome as well." Another former UNI Panther is making his return to Iowa on Saturday. Tight end Briley Moore leads Kansas State in receiving touchdowns with 3 and is second on the team in yards with 271, despite missing the Oklahoma State game. Moore suffered a back injury against West Virginia and missed the Oklahoma State game with the injury. College men's basketball. Iowa Hawkeyes prepare for season of uncertainty. Several of Iowa's basketball players were asked Monday about the uncertainty surrounding the coming season. NCAA Division I teams are supposed to start playing games a week from Wednesday, but many teams, including the Hawkeyes, still do not even have a schedule. The NCAA did announce Monday that it plans to hold the entire NCAA tournament in Indianapolis. It seems as though the cart is being placed in front of the horse, but most of the Hawkeyes tiptoed gently around the question during a Zoom session with reporters. "We're trying to improve as a basketball team every day, so that's been my focus," senior center Luca Garza said. We'll play the games when they arrive. We're just preparing to play on November 25th at a junior Joe Weiskamp. We're just hopeful that opportunity is available. And then there's Jordan Bohannon. The fifth-year senior guard is fully recovered from two hip surgeries, is understandably eager to have a last hurrah. He's never been one to pull punches, and he didn't do that Monday when asked about the current uncertainty. We don't even have a regular season schedule yet, and that's really frustrating on our end because it really affects us mentally on how we prepare for the season, Bohannon said. Right now, there's no plan moving forward, and we hope the next couple of days something comes forward for what's going to happen in the regular season. Right now, it's really frustrating. Does he have faith that the season will come off as planned? I have faith there will be an NCAA tournament because that's where the money comes from, he said. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.